We're calling on Obama right now, today, to call for a stop work order for the Dakota Access Pipeline. This suffering should not go on any longer. The way that peaceful protesters are being treated right now in North Dakota, it's inhumane. It's 2016, and this looks like fascism, what's happening in North Dakota right now.
And on up the street, Alzheimer's and cancer. And across the street, Parkinson's, neurological diseases, and Alzheimer's and cancer. And behind him on the next street, Alzheimer's cancer. And I'm tired of it. And I'm tired of people placating us.
My son's death will not be in vain. His legacy will live on.
That's right.
Forever.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. On the Ground is your D.C.-based show covering activists and activism for social justice in a media world covering everything else but what really matters to the people. Today, we continue to focus on the state of never-ending war and the war of words and so-called soft power by the United States since 9/11. Last week, we discussed how the United States and its allies have bombed or are bombing at least 8 countries in the Middle East and Africa. But what about the rest of Africa? And what about our own hemisphere? What are some of the ways our tax dollars are being used to interfere in the affairs of other countries without guns? We'll be speaking with Carlos Ron, Minister Counselor for Political Affairs for the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, and also Abiyomi Azikwe, Editor of Pan-African Newswire. Also today, an exclusive for On the Ground, residents of West Virginia who have been living with polluted drinking water finally get their face-to-face with officials from the Environmental Protection Agency. So, as always, we have a lot packed into our hour, and we'll get started with our headlines. With less than 4 days to go into the election for the U.S. presidency, efforts are turning to a final push to get out the vote. Many activists from D.C. are heading to nearby battleground states, Pennsylvania and Ohio, to help get out the vote. The election has posed either a dilemma or an opportunity for progressives, like Sarah Browning, founder of D.C. Poets Against the War. She posted on Facebook, "I'm going to Pennsylvania Saturday to help to get out the vote. Those of you who know me know that I have worked my whole life against many things Hillary Clinton stands for, in particular militarism and corporatism. I will continue to fight like hell for justice and peace after Tuesday. And I hear you, friends in other parts of the world, that we in the U.S. discount the severity of the threat to you from a Hillary Clinton presidency. But I believe Donald Trump is a threat to all of us everywhere. He supports additional nuclear proliferation, more nukes. He is a nationalist xenophobe of the worst order. He is a demagogue. He cheats working people. He is the grossest kind of misogynist. And the list goes on. I will not be able to face my child and the other young people inheriting this earth on Wednesday morning if I have not done what I could to defeat him who wants to join me." And again, that's from Sarah Browning, founder of DC Poets Against the War and Split This Rock, posting on Facebook. Well, here for this show's last pre-election analysis is our geopolitical analyst, the prolific writer and activist, Professor Gerald Horn. Thanks for joining us this morning, Gerald. I don't know if you heard my intro, but are progressives torn between what could happen domestically versus internationally with a Trump or Clinton presidency?
Well, I think that's apparent. I think that, as your Facebook poster put it, those who intend to vote for Hillary Rodham Clinton have a very difficult choice. That is to say that it's virtually preordained that if she is elected, there will be a confrontation with Russia. Those who choose to vote for Donald J. Trump should realize that if he is elected, it is preordained that there will be a confrontation with China. So those are the two unappetizing choices presented by the major nominees for U.S. president.
So there's been a lot of attention in the media, even by filmmaker Michael Moore, who was on our station on Democracy Now! a lot of attention in the media to understanding the Trump voter and to distance the typical Trump voter from racism and xenophobia. I even saw a number of people on the thread donating to the church in Mississippi that had been burned. A lot of Trump voters on there saying that, you know, this was a movement by Trump voters to show that they have that they don't approve of that type of racist act. But I know that you actually will be looking to see what percentage of the white vote Trump does get, and what would that percentage mean to you, and what would that tell you?
Well, routinely, the Republicans get 59% to 62% of the so-called white vote. If Donald J. Trump reaches 65%, I think that would be a very dangerous and ominous signal. With regard to Michael Moore and these so-called anti-racist Trump voters, I would like to remind them that just a few days ago, we had a very defining episode. I'm speaking of the acquittal of the white nationalists in Oregon on the same day that Native Americans were routed and arrested peacefully protesting in North Dakota. There were those who suggested that this was some sort of anomaly. If they had a better understanding of U.S. history, they would have realized that this was no anomaly. This was totally consistent and congruent with the historical trajectory of the United States of America. That is to say, patting armed white nationalists on the back while routing Native Americans defending their land. How do they think that this land was taken and settled by millions of Europeans? That kind of naivete, it seems to me, leads directly to downplaying the threat of the Trump presidency, and also leads to a kind of obliviousness when it comes to assessing the deep-seated white supremacy embedded in the typical white Trump voter.
So these are the last few days leading up to the election, and I'm wondering, what are some of the other factors and revelations that you think matter? I mean, they're still coming fast and furious from WikiLeaks on the one hand, and on the other hand, from alleged victims of Donald Trump still coming forward, and revelations about his taxes and his business dealings. So what do you think is really mattering at this point?
Well, I think all of us should be concerned by something that has generally escaped the attention of the progressive movement in the United States. That is to say that the national security establishment of the United States is heavily weighted towards conservatism and towards the Republican Party. That's partially the explanation for the revelations delivered by FBI Director James Comey. And that if you read very carefully the articles, particularly in the Wall Street Journal, you walk away with the idea that FBI agents are living in Trump land, and they are doing everything in their power to help to destabilize the possible Clinton administration. I don't think that this should come as a revelation to those who've been paying attention, but it has not received enough focus. And the same holds true for the article in the New York Times just the other day about all these veterans, military veterans, leaning towards Donald J. Trump. I think overall, the progressive movement has not done a very good job of analyzing what the mainstream press now routinely refers to as white nationalism. Even the New York Times the other day had an article entitled, quote, "The Crisis of Whiteness," unquote, which would have appeared as a revelation to many in the progressive movement who rarely analyze the phenomenon known as whiteness, and is left to the mainstream to do so. But of course, they have weaknesses in doing so. For example, the New York Times article did not have a word to say about how China impacts the crisis of whiteness, nor does the New York Times take responsibility for the fact that its columnist, Timothy Egan, days after the November 12th election, came out four square for routing affirmative action. Now he's soldier number one when it comes to trying to rout Donald J. Trump. That kind of contradiction, of course, is unsustainable. But at the same time, the fact that the progressive movement has abandoned its battle stations with regard to the struggle against white supremacy obviously leads to these kinds of contradictions.
Okay, well, we definitely will be watching and voting here in D.C. We have a statehood referendum or ballot initiative on our ballot here in the district for the district residents to vote for statehood. And we will be looking at what happens with that as well. So thank you, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
In Planet News, water remains at the heart of headlines around the country. The standoff in North Dakota between Native American water protectors and police continued this week, with law enforcement spraying the demonstrators with tear gas and rubber bullets. The protesters, including Native Americans and environmental activists, are trying to block construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline, which they say will endanger drinking water and disturb sacred burial sites. In D.C., protesters, including Vina Trehan and Gabriel Shapiro, gathered in front of the White House on Saturday at a global day of solidarity with Standing Rock, demanding that President Obama do more to enforce the rights of indigenous people.
We're calling on Obama right now, today, to call for a stop work order for the Dakota Access Pipeline. This suffering should not go on any longer. The way that peaceful protesters are being treated right now in North Dakota, it's inhumane. It's 2016, and this looks like fascism, what's happening in North Dakota right now. They have sound cannons. They have pepper spray. They're dropping pepper spray in bulk amounts from helicopters onto peaceful protesters whose arms are up. And this is not democracy. That's not how democracy works. It's not how it was imagined. It's not how it's played out. So we need to do something about this. We need to stand up for those who rightfully live on this land, who've been here for over 300 years.
Today is a global call for action, and so there are rallies being held all over the world, pretty much spontaneously on just a day or two's notice, to stand with Standing Rock.
It was also reported this week that a Nestle bottling plant in Michigan, which has been pumping water out of aquifers for free for years, now wants to more than double the amount of water it can pump out of the ground. The bottling plant that produces Ice Mountain bottled water has been the site of a more than decade-long struggle by local residents who oppose the extraction of the groundwater for profit. And in an on-the-ground exclusive, officials from the Environmental Protection Agency traveled to West Virginia to meet with residents impacted by above-ground storage of hazardous chemicals and residents impacted by a January 2014 spill of toxic chemicals by Freedom Industries into the Elk River. The spill contaminated the potable water supply to over 300,000 people. More on this historic meeting later in the show. Internationally, water was also the focus of a discussion yesterday about Israel's use of Palestinian natural resources. Chantel James has more.
Friends of Palestine and community members gathered at the Palestine Center for a lunchtime discussion on the ways in which Israel's occupation of Palestine has affected the environment. Panelists Maria Farah, Aziel Abu Bakr, and Shawan Jabarin held forth, delivering such critical knowledge as the fact that Israel is currently conducting offshore drilling for Palestinian natural gas. Here, Aziel Abu Bakr discusses the ways in which water has been a battleground in the Palestine-Israeli conflict.
It's widely believed that one of the main reasons why Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967 was to take control over these water resources. And this is reflected in the fact that the first military orders that were passed by the Israeli military commanders dealt with water. The Palestinians are required to request permission from the Israeli Civil Administration if they want to develop their water infrastructure. And in 1982, all of Palestinian water infrastructure and the water resources were transferred to the National Water Company that Maria mentioned, Mekarot. So Palestinians are forced to purchase their water from the Israeli National Water Carrier. And this results in, number one, they pay higher prices than the Israelis pay to use their own water, and they are subject to water shortages. And, this is something that happens on a regular basis. Mekarot will decrease the supply of water that is sent into Palestinian towns to meet the needs of Israelis and Israeli settlers. And this was highlighted in the summer. I'm sure if you guys paid attention, there were severe water shortages. And this was strictly due to the fact that, Israel was controlling the water that was being sent to these Palestinian towns. And then there's also the case of Palestinians who reside in Area C, some of whom are not connected to a water network at all. And in that instance, Palestinians are forced to purchase tankered water. And this tankered water is very expensive. So there's a statistic or something, an estimate that said that Palestinian families in the Jordan Valley who are not connected to a water network have to spend half of their monthly expenditure on the purchase of water. Meanwhile, their neighboring settlements and settlers enjoy unlimited supplies of piped water, and they only spend 0.9% of their monthly income on water resources.
For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
In Black Lives Matter news, after an historic African-American church was burned in Greensboro, Mississippi, a GoFundMe online campaign to make repairs at the church has raised $200,000. When we checked earlier this morning, it was first set up to only raise $10,000. Here in D.C., Beverly Smith and dozens of her supporters marked the one-year anniversary of the death of Smith's son, Alonzo Smith, with a candlelight vigil on Tuesday night outside the Southeast D.C. apartment complex where he died in the custody of special police last year. After prosecutors declined to indict officers in her son's death, Smith is continuing an independent investigation and said at the vigil that she intends to launch a foundation in his memory.
My son have a 7-year-old son named Makai, who will never have the opportunity to know what a great man my son Alonzo was. Alonzo was a teacher aide at Accotink Academy School in Springfield, Virginia. Alonzo had a passion, a gift, and a calling of teaching, particularly kids who have learning and behavioral challenges. They adored my son, and my son adored his kids. He lived for those kids. And to continue my son's legacy, I had decided on yesterday that I am going to found the Alonzo Fierro Smith Foundation. And this foundation is going to assist financially and other needs of school-age kids who have behavior and learning challenges. My son's death will not be in vain. His legacy will live on forever.
After prayers and words of support, those gathered released silvery heart-shaped balloons into the night sky and sang along to a recording of Rise by Andra Day. Also in D.C., the family of Mark George is demanding answers after the 23-year-old man was shot 3 times and critically wounded by a Metropolitan Police Department officer on October 14th. Police said the shooting occurred after they responded to a call about gunshots heard in the area. They said that George ran after they approached him and pointed a gun at them, an account disputed by witnesses. The family demanded body cam video of the shooting, but the department said that no footage was available because the officers involved were undercover officers who did not use body cameras. This week, Black Lives Matter DC organized a Twitter storm to raise awareness about the case. George was in critical condition at the hospital, and according to news reports, is now at the D.C. jail. In culture and media, the premiere of Debbie Allen's multimedia stage work, Freeze Frame, ended its brief run at the Kennedy Center earlier this week. Lydia Curtis has more.
Debbie Allen premiered her new musical, Freeze Frame, at the Kennedy Center, chronicling the effects and aftermath of gun violence in communities of color. Allen, who wrote and produced the play, with music written by her son, Norman Nixon, said in an interview with Access Hollywood that this piece was 30 years in the making.
When I came here to do Fame, I just could not become desensitized to the senseless deaths every day, the gang violence, fights with the police. Yeah. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah. And so I started writing it then. I thought it was going to be a movie called Rage. And time took its toll, and I got involved in different things, but it never left me.
The musical has high production values and great visuals. The opening scene is an action-packed pairing of videos and on-stage action, and the dancing is hip and flawless. The story is a tragic case of mistaken identity, and as the play unfolds, we get to know and love each character. This piece, like all of Debbie Allen's pieces, is written for teens, so for the older adults in the audience, some of the scenes were a bit cliched, but it is perfect for its target audience and leaves you with a lot to talk about. Allen would like the play to be performed in venues across the country. This is Lydia Curtis signing off from Northwest Washington.
And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, the current U.S. role in Africa and South America. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
decisions that are made by you. But we are sick and tired of hearing the song telling how you are gonna change right from wrong. Cause if you really want to hear our views, you haven't done nothing.
That was Stevie Wonder, You Haven't Done Nothing, on the ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam. Well, today we continue to focus on the state of never-ending war and the war of words and of so-called soft power by the United States since 9/11. Last week we discussed how the United States and its allies have bombed or are bombing at least 8 countries in the Middle East and Africa. But what about the rest of Africa? And what about our own hemisphere? What are some of the ways our tax dollars are being used to interfere in the affairs of other countries without guns? With me in studio is Carlos Ron, Minister Counselor for Political Affairs for the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. And joining me via Skype is Abayomi Azikwe, Editor of Pan-African Newswire. Good morning to both of you. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you.
Abayomi, let's start in Africa. October 20th, just 2 weeks ago, marked 5 years since the leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, was murdered. And then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, now our presidential candidate, was captured in the infamous video cackling about his murder. And since then, Libya has descended into chaos that has spread through much of the continent. And so 5 years later, what is the most significant fallout from the Libyan intervention and assassination of Gaddafi, in your opinion? I know that he was going to switch currency, I think, for selling oil, and he had many projects underway to assist sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes, the government in Libya had transformed the country into the most prosperous state on the African continent. It had been a very, very underdeveloped country as a result of decades of Italian colonialism, as well as British and United States military involvement there. The Wheelis Air Base had been constructed during World War II, and it served as a major conduit for U.S. military operations during World War II in West Africa, West Africa and North Africa. North Africa in particular, because some of the fiercest military battles that were waged during World War II were waged in North Africa, in Libya, as well as in Egypt. And in response to your question about the impact of the U.S. Bombing, regime change, and assassination of Gaddafi, is that Libya today has been rendered to a source, a major source of instability, not only in North Africa, but also in West Africa, as well as extending across the Mediterranean into southern, eastern, and central Europe. We see every single day, people are dying in the Mediterranean as a result of the human trafficking operations that are taking place. Just yesterday, at least 240 people were killed as two boats sank in the Mediterranean. This is according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. There's been a total, according to the official figures, of 4,220 people who have been killed so far this year as a result of human trafficking from Libya to southern Europe. So this is a monumental crisis. It is fueling the worst humanitarian and crisis of displacement since the conclusion of World War II. We're talking about 60 to 75 million people, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, been dislocated both domestically as well as internationally as we speak in 2016.
You know, one follow-up. When, I guess 2 weeks ago, when we marked Congo Week and the 20th anniversary of the invasion of the Congo by soldiers and mercenaries from Uganda and Rwanda, Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, discussed a meeting or a summit that the U.S. was involved in that brought many of the current African dictators to power. And, you know, he rattled off the countries, you know, Uganda, Rwanda, Ethiopia. And do these dictators remain basically as the world order in Africa today?
Yes. The United States is heavily involved in trying to control and manipulate politics in Africa. And we don't hear a lot about it through the corporate media or the government-controlled media, and even in the so-called left press in this country, it's largely ignored or minimized or suppressed. So it's something I feel very strongly about, that those forces within the African anti-imperialist movement in this country has to put this issue at the forefront. And we talk about what happened in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1998, where a war erupted that was largely carried out at the aegis of the United States. Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State during that time period, gave a talk at George Mason University where she said that the administration of Laurent Kabila, which had been in power for a little over a year, needed to be removed. And several months later, we had this large-scale invasion. Fortunately, the Southern African Development Community at the time, its military portfolio was headed by Zimbabwe, and they were able to send in troops along with Namibia as well as Angola to beat back this intervention. And that was the only thing that prevented the Kabila government from being totally overthrown. So these things are going on in Libya. They're bombing every single day. There was a report on yesterday that now they're using helicopter gunships to ostensibly attack Islamic State bases inside of Sirte. Okay. But these bases were established as a result of the destabilization that's been fostered by U.S. imperialism.
Okay. Now, Carlos, I have similar questions for you. We don't officially or otherwise that I know of have any soldiers in South America or Central America, but I'm more conscious of the role of NGOs and other forms of so-called soft power by the U.S. in that area. So can you give me an update on, well, give me your assessment of that?
Well, I should start saying, but there's always been a group of organizations that have some receive funding from different agencies in the United States or outside of the United States, and they go under this idea of democracy promotion. And sometimes it's very questionable because there's participation of these organizations into national politics, and they're being funding from outside, whether it be state funding or other type of funding. We've had that in Venezuela. As a matter of fact, a lot of these organizations have participated not only at one point in time against in a coup attempt against President Chavez, but back in 2014, where there were a series of also violent demonstrations against the government and trying to overthrow President Maduro, there was a presence of these organizations. So you see this is a recurring factor that sort of plays against democratically elected governments in our region. And the reason, I think the reason being, as a matter of fact, 11 years ago today, there was the Summit of the Americas in Mar del Plata, which was very historic because it was when many of the countries in South America decided to opt out of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas and marked a turning point, you could say, in the region, because these were governments that were that had a strong popular support and were, you know, an anti-neoliberal agenda, right. Had a more popular agenda, more towards the development of the people themselves and not of corporations. 11 years ago, that was a turning point. And what you see going on today is precisely a sort of persecution by the right wing in our countries against those governments that took that stand 11 years ago.
Right. And a lot of these groups are funded by the U.S. interests or organizations or people or other people outside of the country, in other words. So even though we don't see kind of military action like we see in Africa, we do see a lot of violence in Central and South America. I'm thinking recently the assassination of two leaders in Honduras, and everyone is still conscious of the murder of Berta Cáceres, the environmental list. And what is the link between our support? Of course, we're supporting that government. The U.S. is supplying military and other aid to Honduras. So, I mean, that's obvious, but what are some of the other links that you see in terms of how we are basically our tax dollars are being used to destabilize Central and South America?
Well, I could speak in a sense about some actions that are not, I would say, that are not helpful in some cases. For example, in Venezuela, in the past, in 2014, when there were a series of violent protests against the governments, you had a set of statements and all these declarations by Congress, sanctions that were later imposed on Venezuela. Today, we're still called a national security threat to the United States. Those things, the way they affect is that they sort of give a green light to these violent groups.
Right.
You know, because they feel they have international support, and that's a dangerous precedent. I mean, if you take into account, for example, in recent days, the United States has supported dialogue in Venezuela, which is a positive step in regards to that large picture. But in the past, when you have all these sanctions imposed, or you have calls for support for these groups that are carrying out violence, what you do is undermine the authority of, you know, the laws of the state, undermine the you know, the people, the people's votes, basically, who elected a government and to want to see that government fulfill its mandate.
All right. Now, most recently, actually, it was the first time I heard this, a number of progressive activists used the term National Petroleum Radio to refer to NPR. I hadn't heard that before, but they're basically talking about how so much of National Public Radio is funded by these oil giants, energy giants, and the coverage that they give of Venezuela is very harsh, to say the least. I can't help but think that the media is another form of U.S. soft power in terms of shaping a public opinion and perspectives on what's happening in Venezuela.
Well, there's undoubtedly a massive media campaign against Venezuela and against our government. It's not the first time we've been, you know, through this for the last 17 years or so. But there's a strong push in the last few years to, especially against President Maduro, to undermine his government, to paint a situation in Venezuela that's different from what it truly is. I mean, the National Assembly in Venezuela right now, which is dominated by the opposition, the right wing opposition, talks about coming to the Organization of American States and finding support, international support for their cause and to delegitimize the government of President Maduro. That only happens when you have the support of the press so that you could sell that narrative. And at the same time, you see it's very difficult for the government and the popular movements in Latin America to reply to that narrative or to sort of counter it, because there are no spaces. I mean, for example, this space right here is one of very few spaces. And I'll give an example. Washington Post writes on average about daily articles on Venezuela, describing the situation as something that's not accurate and making it look as if Venezuela is in the middle of a humanitarian crisis and so forth. And you know, it's a newspaper that when we've tried to reply, when we try to send something out and say, hey, you got this wrong, we need a letter to, you know, the editor or something like that, they've told us you can only do that once every 6 months. So they could write about us every day, but we can only defend ourselves Wow. once every 6 months. So that sort of shows how there's a lot of strength in the mainstream Right. media's narrative, and how difficult it is for popular movements in the region to
get
counteract.
Past that. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, Abayomi, I wanted to ask you about AFRICOM. I think a lot of people don't really know what that is. What is AFRICOM, and what kind of impact is it having on Africa?
Well, it is a special command force that was started in 2008 to specifically deal with the African continent. But I just wanted to mention, too, that In Honduras in 2009, the U.S. was behind the overthrow of the government there.
Yes.
In Ecuador in 2010, they attempted to overthrow the Correa government. In Paraguay, they did engineer a political coup against Fernando Lugo. And, of course, in Brazil, they were instrumental in creating the conditions for a political coup against Dilma Rousseff. And Venezuela right now is really on the brink. Cuba, even though they claim they've somewhat normalized relations, they still have the sanctions and the embargo imposed, which is making it very difficult for Cuba to operate. But in regard to Africa, it's very important because in South America, the majority of the population are of African and indigenous descent. So we have a very close connection politically with South America and Central America and the Caribbean. There's a South America-Africa summit that's held three different conferences, but both areas are targets of U.S. Military and intelligence destabilization operations. AFRICOM has announced publicly that they are escalating U.S. military presence there. They do joint military operations with various governments, naval operations with various governments. They're bombing Somalia almost on a weekly basis under the guise of fighting Islamic terrorism. So this is something that the left in this country should be concerned about. And I don't see enough attention being paid to either U.S. military involvement in Africa or in South America.
So what are some of the other impacts that AFRICOM, I suppose, and other U.S. roles are having in Africa?
Well, the first major project was the bombing of Libya and the overthrowing of the Jemahiriya government headed by Muammar Gaddafi. They're also involved in Somalia. They're funding and training 22,000 African Union mission to Somalia troops that have been stationed there since 2007, and they have done nothing to stabilize the country. You have huge food deficits there, continuing internecine conflicts. So therefore, the presence of U.S. military operatives in Africa has really brought about more destabilization. If you look at Mali, where there's a lot of U.S. military intervention, the situation has still not been stabilized. Even in Nigeria, for example, which is the largest populated state in Africa, and according to the Western financial institutions, has been the number one economic power there, although it goes back and forth between South Africa and Nigeria. The Nigerian government has an insurgency in the northeast called Boko Haram, and they have literally been begging the United States to supply arms and to share intelligence, and they have systematically refused to do so. So it raises a whole lot of questions about the role of Boko Haram in this insurgency in the northeast of Nigeria. Those are two good examples. In South Africa, the ANC has charged the U.S. Embassy with destabilization efforts there out of the United States Embassy in Pretoria. And last year, they had suspended South Africa from the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act agreements because they wanted to dump what South Africa considered poultry products that did not meet their standards.
Okay. So
these are just some of the operations they're involved in.
So I guess both of you, I have to wrap up this segment, but when I spoke to Maurice Carney for the show on the Congo a couple weeks ago, he talked about the Talema movement in the Congo, and this is a movement of young people, kind of like a revolutionary movement to basically, it's a people's uprising. And we kind of talked about that as kind of a ray of hope in terms of people's movements, a people's movement in Africa. So I guess I want to ask both of you about the people, the organizations, the movements that you know about that are hoping to counter what the U.S. is doing in Africa and in Central and South America. You could start first, Carlos.
Well, I think just place into perspective for the listeners, you know, we have to be careful, all progressives all around the world have to be careful and watch very closely what goes on in Latin America right now. Because there's an up scaling of upscale of right wing movements and trying to control the control power, and they're doing this like we said, not in the traditional military coup that we've seen before, but we see it through other subtle ways. For example, they've conquered the parliaments in one place, or they dominate some courts, and then that's how you see some of the things, some of the issues that take place in, for example, in the coup in Brazil, like our friend was saying, and other places as well, where their attempts to undermine President Maduro in Venezuela through the National Assembly and other places like that. And there are popular movements that some of them which are in power, and there are others that are, you could say, in resistance. For example, in Brazil, just to name one, you have the Landless Movement, which is a very strong movement working for land reform and for social justice in Brazil, who actually this morning they've been stormed by some police officers, apparently in attempt to persecute some of their leadership. So these are the kind of things that you have to watch out for and see, you know, what's going
on
there.
Pay attention to, right.
But definitely, I think there's the important thing is to know that people changed too during the last 17 years in Latin America. There's a more consciousness about the rights that, you know, we've been able to conquer in labor, in you know, land, and just the way society and democracy itself, you know, more participatory democracy in many countries. People
aren't going to go back to being like a banana republic.
Exactly,
right?
And we must be very very read very well the codes and what comes out in the media, and because of what they're going to try to do is present popular movements as being subversive. Now they're trying to take the narrative, take the languages, and sort of turn them around and try to accuse what really are the democratic and popular movements and right now in the world.
Wow. And Abayomi, in Africa, in addition to the Talema movement, in the Congo, this movement of young people in the Congo, what are some of the other popular resistance movements in Africa?
Well, they're all over, but we have to be very careful because some of these groups are funded, you know, by the United States State Department, and we have to look what their ideological orientations really are. We have tremendous evidence over the last 5.5 years. We had uprisings in Egypt, in Tunisia, and other countries, which inevitably led right back to U.S. and European domination. In Egypt, we saw a lack of any real political leadership or ideological orientation, and the army was able to take over the government again, and we're right back to where we were in essence under Mubarak. Same situation in Tunisia. Some of the people who were part of the Ben Ali regime prior to 2011 are now back in power in Tunisia. So we have to be very careful when we look and we see some of these so-called popular movements that have surfaced in the Middle East, in Africa, as well as in Latin America, and try to judge them based upon what they're actually saying.
Okay.
Some of them are advocating policies that are far to the right to the existing governments.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Carlos Ron, Minister Counselor for Political Affairs for the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, and Abayomi Ezekwe. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
When we come back, an on-the-ground exclusive, residents of West Virginia who have been living with polluted drinking water finally get their face-to-face with officials from the Environmental Protection Agency. Stay with us.
Texas obscene. We've got it twisted in this lucid dream, baptized in boundaries, schooled in sin, divided by difference, sexuality and skin. Oh, so we can hate each other and fear each other. We can build these walls between each other, baby, blow by blow and brick by brick. Keep yourself locked in.
That was Holy War, cut from the Alicia Keys album that drops today on the ground, ontheground.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Rivera, and I'm joined on the line by Michelle Roberts, our environmental justice producer, who is just back from West Virginia, where she took part in an historic meeting where people were laying down the gospel to EPA officials. Good morning, Michelle. Tell us what happened.
Good morning, Esther. It was a historic meeting. The room was packed. Residents came from the historic community of Institute, West Virginia, and other places of Charleston to Canal City to actually tell their stories to the government on how they were impacted by the continuing crisis from the Freedom Industries disaster that took place back in 2014. The most beautiful part is that...
Tell us about just refresh our memory about what happened in 2014.
Sure. You may recall back in 2014, early January, a tank, an above-ground storage tank, leaked thousands of gallons of toxic contaminants into the Elk River. And interestingly enough, that particular contaminant is what they used to so-called clean the coal, Esther. And so with respect to that, that actually co-opted over 300,000 people from having the ability to clean and safe drinking water, bathing water, and what have you. And to this day, people are still purchasing water. As we think about Flint, these folks are purchasing bottled water to not only drink and cook, but they're also bathing, buying 5-gallon bottles to bathe daily.
So actually, we have a clip of one of the speakers there, I think Sue Ann Davis, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's play that.
But I too use bottled water. I don't bathe in this water, and it's costing me a fortune. It's costing me a fortune. And I've got every receipt for every jug of water and every bottle of water I've bought in the last 3 years. And it's tearing me up, but I don't trust the water. I too lost a neighbor this week. Lost many neighbors since that happened. And nobody cares why. Nobody's really even looking to find out why. And I lost my neighbor this week, and it makes me angry. Because in his house, there were 3 different aneurysms of a 17-year-old, a 19-year-old, and his beloved wife. Then he comes down with a neurological disease. And then he comes down with cancer. And it took him out of here this week. And on up the street, Alzheimer's and cancer. And across the street, Parkinson's, neurological diseases, and Alzheimer's and cancer. And behind him on the next street, Alzheimer's, cancer. Nobody can go on and on and on and on. Talk about my own house. And I'm tired of it. And I'm tired of people placating us.
So that was Sue Ann Davis speaking yesterday to the EPA officials who traveled to West Virginia. So what's going to happen now, Michelle? We're kind of running out of time. What's going to happen now after this meeting?
This meeting, we are actually engaged in a process with the government where the government must implement the final rule to protect hazardous waste from spilling into, hazardous materials from spilling into the river. It will be a 3.5-year process that we have a consent decree that make sure that this must be completed in 3.5 years. This is not just about West Virginia, Esther. This is about communities across the nation where there are above ground storage tanks near vulnerable spaces like water systems. And also, quickly, what's very important to know about Sue Ann Davis, Sue Ann Davis is one of our environmental justice heroes, if you will. She attended the first People of Color Summit. Her family actually donated the land, if you will, for the historic college, West Virginia State College. So it's very important that we make sure that this community is deeply honored, as well as all communities who are suffering from these egregious activities. We hope to have a stronger program on this later, if possible, bringing different voices together, including the attorneys and the community people on the ground who are people concerned about chemical safety who are pushing this piece.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Michelle, and definitely we'll definitely stay on the story and follow all the developments. And that will do it for us on the ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance. A special thanks to my guest, Abiyomi Azikwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, and Carlos Ron, minister counselor for the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Thanks to Chantel James, Lydia Curtis, and Michael Byfield for their contribution to today's show. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella, and thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Averam. I'll be participating in the opening tonight of X-Exchange, a showcase of women artists and makers. That's at Area 405 Gallery in Baltimore. And also, this Sunday, I'll be in conversation with another WPFW programmer, Fahima Sek, at ACTOR, a continuing talk on race at Busboys and Poets, 14th and V Northwest. That's Sunday at 5 p.m. We'll be talking about the Birth of a Nation movie, the elections, and this nation's reckoning with history. Now stay tuned for a community watch and comment. Raise your voice out there. Peace.